Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to the University of New England's President's Forum. Today's panel is titled Maine's Homelessness Crisis. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
Good evening, everyone. I'm James Herbert. For those that don't know me, I'm the president of University of New England, and thank you all so much for joining us for the latest event in our President's Forum series. So I'm going to make a few introductory remarks before I introduce our guests. It goes without saying that we live in hyper-polarized times. At the national level and increasingly at the local level, too, the animosity between entrenched ideological camps in our country manifests itself in many ways. We see how it manifests itself in our federal government and how it functions, or more precisely, fails to function. We see it in both traditional and social media, and we also all witness it in our daily lives. Where politics are concerned, the insults are many and serious conversations are few, unfortunately. And practically every issue today quickly becomes a political one. Each President's Forum event consists of a moderated discussion that allows us to take a deep dive into a controversial topic from various angles. Along the way, we hope to model how to have productive discourse. We will apply these principles to tonight's discussion, which directs our attention to the rising number of people experiencing homelessness. So now, let's meet our guests. First of all, Cullen Ryan is Executive Director of Community Housing of Maine, the largest supporting housing provider for homeless and special needs populations in the state. Cullen, thank you for coming. Yes. Danielle West is the city manager of Portland, which operates the largest municipal shelter and one of a small number of municipal public health departments in the state. Danielle, thank you. And Allie Lovejoy is Vice President for Mission Advancement at Preble Street, a social work agency that has been serving the most vulnerable populations in Maine for nearly 50 years. So thank you, Allie, for joining us. Thank you all for taking time out of your very busy schedules to be here with us this evening. And joining our guests is UNE Assistant Clinical Professor of Public Health, Courtney Jeffers, who will serve as tonight's moderator. Thank you, Courtney, also.
Thanks, President Herbert. I'm really happy to be here with the three of you. We know that homelessness is not just about shelter, right? It's also this complex, multifaceted issue, especially if you take into account economic stability, having safe places to play and live and work, access to healthcare. There are so many different things that go into making this a very complicated issue. People who are chronically homeless often have more chronic disease, and think about if you have diabetes and you are living outside, how do you keep your insulin refrigerated? There are just lots of different things that compound. So we recognize how complex this public health issue is, and also with nearly 70 years of cumulative experience on this stage in municipality, housing, direct services, we have some really great information for you, and we recognize that it's really complicated. So. Before we start with the questions, I want to turn it over to our panelists to kind of introduce a little bit about what they do and their perspective on the issue. And we'll start with you, Allie.
Great. Thanks so much, Courtney. Danielle and Cullen, I'm glad to be here with you today. And thank you all for having us. As President Herbert mentioned, my name is Allie Lovejoy. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm the Vice President of Mission Advancement at Preble Street. Preble Street is an almost 50-year-old social service agency whose mission is to provide accessible, barrier-free services to empower people experiencing problems with homelessness, hunger, housing, and poverty, and to advocate for solutions to those problems. And Preble Street, when it began, was a bit of an experiment by a University of Southern Maine, so a neighbor to the north, professor of social work, or the head of the social work department, Joe Chrysler, who believed strongly in the dignity of every human being and the power of relationship to help bring people back into community who've been marginalized. And in our 50 years, we have enjoyed the benefit of not just the University of Southern Maine social work interns who helped Joe Chrysler found Preble Street or start Preble Street, but also 3 decades of University of New England interns as well. So I want to say thank you to the University of New England and to the students here. This is a not so subtle invitation to come join us in our work. 50 years is a long time of doing social work, and it is certainly long enough to see the impacts of seemingly small decisions on vulnerable members of our community. Even the 15 years that I've been with Preble Street has been long enough to see how decisions made not just at federal levels, but also at state and local levels can have significant impacts on people who are experiencing homelessness, who are struggling with issues related to mental health, substance use, poverty. Those decisions can have monumental impacts, and I'm excited to talk tonight about how those decisions, the power that all of us as community members can have in that decision-making to ensure that the policies, that the systems that we build to support people actually meet the needs of the people that we're aiming to serve. Preble Street was founded with the idea that when we build relationship with the people we're trying to serve and do deep listening into what those individuals are facing, then we can find solutions that are good for both the individual and the community, that we find better solutions when we are responsive to the things that are actually, that the folks that we are serving are actually facing. And so, so we use models such as harm reduction and being trauma-informed to ensure that we are really listening and being responsive to the needs of the people that we're serving. And so I think that for Preble Street, the issues regarding housing and homelessness, the increase of those and the solutions to those are always grounded in those things. Over our 50 years, we've grown from a very Bayside neighborhood, Portland-centric day shelter drop-in to now an organization that has services statewide for individuals facing homelessness, hunger, and poverty. We have a food security hub to provide food for individuals and families experiencing hunger. We have emergency shelters for youth, for women, and for folks who have experienced unsheltered homelessness and don't have access to any other shelter. We have housing programs that speak to the needs of individuals who have experienced chronic homelessness by having on-site social work support during non-traditional hours to ensure that people are getting their needs met. And so throughout that spectrum of services, both the emergency needs of ensuring that if somebody is hungry, that we are going to make sure that they have access to a meal, and if somebody is homeless, we're doing our best to ensure that they have access to a safe bed to sleep in. So our emergency programs, through the spectrum to our solutions-based work with our Housing First programs for chronically homeless individuals, those themes of dignity and respect and listening are really present throughout all our programs. Thank you so much for having me tonight. I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me as well. I am the city manager for Portland. I've been in that position for almost 2 years, just over 2 years actually. And it's an extremely complicated job because, as Allie just talked about, she talked about one sort of piece of the puzzle that I have to look at when making decisions. We make decisions that impact a wide variety of people, obviously residents, businesses, visitors, everyone who comes through the city of Portland, which is a significant group of people. And so obviously we're balancing all of those things and trying to listen to all of those individuals, but also listening to the chronically homeless and unhoused as well. And so that makes our piece of this very, very complicated. You're trying to balance all of those interests, which I can tell you for the number of sleepless nights that I've had over the last 2 years, it's not easy. It's not something that comes easily. It requires a lot of discourse. It requires a lot of doing, as President Herbert talked about, listening and really making sure that you're doing so and listening to both sides of an issue, whether it's the side you agree with or the side that you disagree with. So that has been extremely complicated. My background, I've been with the city for 16 years. I've been in municipal government for about 20 years, most of that as a lawyer. Don't hold that against me. And I then proceeded to come into working as the city manager. And I think that's helped educate me because I've understood that political process I just described and really try to help the council, who is my boss, make good educated decisions that balances the needs of all of those groups that I just mentioned. And so specifically with regard to homelessness, I am so proud to be a member of city staff who provide and house a significant number of those unhoused individuals that Allie was speaking of. We have the two largest low barrier shelters within the state of Maine, and they are the only municipally operated low barrier shelters within the state of Maine. So that is not something that we take lightly. We try to balance the needs of all of the staff members that have work out at those facilities, as well as addressing all the various needs of the individuals that are there. So services, and I'll describe the first one, is our homeless services center. We had 208 beds when we opened that in March of 2023. After some work with the council this past year and former Mayor Snyder, who she and I spent a lot of time on this issue, we were able to add an additional 50 beds out there. So we house 258 individuals most nights at that shelter. That's a significant number of people. We have, I brought with me some notes about what a low barrier shelter looks like. And so that means we're open 24/7. We ensure that they have warm meals. Obviously, we don't require that you not be on substances if you come there looking for services. We've adjusted our curfews and tried to address all of the various issues of anyone who has expressed that they don't want to come for some perceived barrier so that we can make sure that we're serving everybody out there in the public. Additionally, we have a family shelter that is always full. That houses a significant number of asylum seekers currently at the moment, but it houses families and addresses the needs of families. And then additionally, that second large shelter that I talked about that the council worked hard to develop this past spring, we refer to it as 166 Riverside. That one addresses specifically asylum seekers. So when we saw the proliferation of tents and encampments in the city of Portland over this past year, maybe year plus, we recognized early on that the need was we need to build capacity. We need to find a way in which to house people so that they get the services they need and we help them address, you know, any sort of issues they have to get them back on their feet again. And so that's why we worked so diligently and so hard to make sure that those two shelters, as well as our family shelter, continue to operate. I consistently say that our biggest policy document in the city is our budget. If you were to look at our budget, we spend a significant amount of money on health and human services and on the social services part of that budget. That is what pays for all of the services I just mentioned. And that's because the council and staff, we care deeply about this issue. When the council set its goals this past year, homelessness, housing were, among others, the biggest goals that the council wants to address. And so I think that I come at this trying to balance all those various interests, as I mentioned up front, but also making sure that we continue to provide those great services and work with the council to continue to provide them, and then try to address any sort of issues we see pop up along the way. The sort of last piece in our puzzle that I'll put out there that we constantly are sort of managing is honestly a levels of government above us who make other decisions that we have to try to deal with and address. And the way that this is paid for is what we call the General Assistance Program, and that is a state program. And that program is managed through the State Department of Health and Human Services, but it's funded through the legislature. And so it's something that we're always trying to work and tweak with them and make sure we address so that we can continue to provide these services and be able to address the needs of everyone in our community, as well as with the working with the federal delegation as well to address various issues that come up, whether it be work authorization periods, trying to work to reduce that so we can get asylum seekers back to work more rapidly. These are all things on a daily basis that city staff work to address, and as I said, I'm very proud to be a part of that. We are very consistently working to make sure that we address all of the needs of everybody in the community and continue to try to balance that as we move forward. So a much sort of, I guess, broader perspective from the seat that I have to sit in. So thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it and look forward to the conversation.
Good evening. Thank you as well for having me and to President Herbert and to UNE for sponsoring this forum. I'm really pleased to be here tonight because I believe that we can end homelessness. And so I guess I'm the optimistic one here. And there's a lot of reasons why. We've proven that we know how to do it. We know that there are five distinct populations. We know each of those populations needs to end their homelessness. And it's just a matter of us as a society deciding to do it. I have been working in the field for 37 years in Vermont, in Minneapolis, and in Maine for the last 28 years. And I've done all sorts of things in the field, including running the largest homeless shelter, doing street outreach, doing case management, doing diversion, doing crisis work, and ultimately housing. And I've been working at Community Housing of Maine for the last 20 years. And that's a very small nonprofit, 12 of us work there. But we have a large footprint because we collaborate with 50 different service providers to house homeless and special needs populations around the state. So we take care of the housing and we collaborate with service providers that provide services that really allow that housing to work for populations. And that, in my mind, is what we need to end homelessness. We need housing and we need services. And homelessness is a symptom of a lot of our systems not working well for populations. The areas of the country where we see the highest level of homelessness are in areas where we have the least amount of housing affordability. So it's no surprise that we're seeing a growth in homelessness in Maine, that we saw really high numbers out on the West Coast, and in all other areas where it's gotten just tremendously expensive. And the last time we had an adequate supply of affordable housing in this country was in 1977. We made strategic decisions to cut budgets of major government programs that changed the playing field for housing. In the 1980s, we essentially invented homelessness. We didn't have wide-scale homelessness before that. But by cutting HUD's budget in half, we saw a whole lot of people who were on the margins unable to afford housing and start to show up, and we created a homeless system to serve them. It rebounded again in the early 2000s when HUD's budget was cut again. So when we cut HUD's budget and we cut out housing, we see homelessness rise. And so the solutions are right in front of us. We have to decide that we want to rebuild the supply of affordable housing, level the playing field for people in terms of accessibility, and just decide that that's what we're going to do instead of having homelessness. And that is a decision that all of us have yet to make. Let's see. I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you for all your commitment and your care here. So we heard about barriers in a couple different ways. We heard about some individual barriers, some municipal barriers, some layered barriers. And we can't talk about solutions until we really know the barriers, right? Because we need relevant solutions for relevant barriers. So aside from individual challenges, which are very important, I'm going to start with you, Allie. What are the biggest roadblocks that you see in dealing with the homelessness crisis here?
That's a great question. So can you just tell me, when you're talking about individual versus other, just explain that a little bit more for me. I want to make sure I'm answering the question you're asking.
Sure. you do direct service, so we know that you deal with a lot of individual challenges. Do you experience roadblocks at bigger levels, whether it be legislation, whether it be community partnerships, things that you need for Preble Street? Are there roadblocks that allow you, that keep you from being able to do your job as well as you want to do it?
Yeah, I think that the biggest roadblock, I mean, there are multiple, and I think that the biggest roadblock that the biggest roadblocks that we see in our work at Preble Street have to do with trying to fit individuals into systems that are not designed or flexible enough to serve them effectively, and a lack of funding to fund the solutions that we know exist. So I'll just take those two parts. We have mental health systems that don't necessarily work for people who are also experiencing substance use. We have systems of substance use systems that don't necessarily work for people who have complex healthcare needs. We have billing systems for all of those things that don't actually work for people who are experiencing the active trauma of homelessness or the complexity of intersectional challenges. So we have to challenge, the systems, and systems means we have to challenge the providers, we have to challenge the various levels of government, we have to challenge one another to make sure that the systems that we have for work for folks. And you know, a ready example of that is in our emergency shelters. Preble Street operates two of the only 5 privately operated low barrier shelters in the state, the other low barrier shelter being the Homeless Services Center. And low barrier shelters, by definition, are designed to ensure that the barriers that might exist due to requiring somebody, the barriers that might keep somebody out of shelter, out of being able to access services, like an expectation of sobriety, like an expectation that you're going to show your ID, like an expectation that you are going to commit to some kind of treatment plan, that those barriers do not need to exist, and that we can better serve clients if we don't, if we reduce those barriers, we can actually engage people in a way that they will benefit from. And I think what we see is that there are systems that are designed to work in the narratives that we have of what it means for somebody who's experiencing homelessness. There are narratives that are designed to say, oh, well, if we have a shelter bed, then we should expect somebody to go into it. That seems like a no-brainer. But the reality is it's not a no-brainer for somebody who's experiencing homelessness to just decide to go into a shelter bed if that shelter doesn't feel like a safe place for them. And there are a lot of good reasons why a shelter might not feel like a safe place for somebody. So I think we have to make sure that we don't just throw out solutions that we think are solutions because, like, oh, there's a solution for that. You know, we have mental health services, we have substance use services. People just aren't taking them, without understanding that actually there are barriers inside those systems, and that there needs to be sustained funding for those programs that are going to go out there and reduce the barriers to people actually being able to take advantages of the services provided.
Danielle, you want to try that one?
Yeah, I definitely want to jump in. I think that as a municipality, I hear definitely what Allie is saying. I think the hardest, so funding is always something from a municipal perspective that's really difficult. We get the majority of our budgetary money in most cases from the property tax. And so that's really difficult in trying to balance the needs of the property taxpayers. But we also get a significant amount of reimbursement through that general assistance program from the state that funds this issue specifically. And a lot of times, that's always the place that they want to cut. And so that's difficult. And so, you know, we've had to spend a significant amount of time trying to advocate for one-time funds or additional reimbursement from the state, especially in the last few years. And that makes it very difficult for us. It makes it very difficult to budget. You have to put your budget in place so that you can commit your property taxes. There's very specific deadlines for that. So it makes it a very complicated issue. And the other piece, I mean, I had written down a couple of different things. Funding was one. The other one is that it's really tough to say this, but we can't, as a municipality, be everything to everyone. And so that, in and of itself, that little nugget is tough. And it's a tough pill to swallow. And it makes the council's job, when they have to make decisions about this issue, very, very difficult. They have to decide and they have to balance all those interests I talked about at the beginning and decide what they think is in the best interest of the city of Portland. And that's really what they're thinking about all the time. And they're doing that from a variety of perspectives that may not always line up with all of our community partners, all of our various interest groups, whether it be the Chamber of Commerce, the business community, residents, visitors, all of those things. So it's a very difficult thing. And that is a barrier that I think we've consistently come up against and tried to manage and address. Additionally, I would say, another barrier from our perspective is housing, as Cullen talked about. It's, you know, a three-lane highway. It's, for us, it's emergency shelter, which we talked about. We have a significant amount of in Portland right now, I think, from the Homeless Services Center and those other facilities I talked about. But it's transitional housing. It's sort of that middle ground that we're looking for people to develop. And then it's permanent housing. And I think we need all three of those things in order to address the needs of this community. And it's tough. It's hard because, yet again, going back to that nugget I talked about, that we as a city can't be everything to everyone. We need other municipalities to step up and fill that gap. We need other, quite honestly, developers to fill that gap. And we've tried to work hard with some to come up with creative solutions to try to address the need. And we also, it's interesting because it also involves even our city code, which is, I won't go too far into the weeds in that, but that code sets out exactly how we want to develop the city, what it should look like, how much housing, where the housing should be, where, quite honestly, shelters should be placed. And so you have to take all of those things into consideration when you're trying to develop a project, and that impacts how housing is developed, how quickly it can be developed. That process can take some time. And also resources to make sure that all that gets done. So that's another barrier that I see from my perspective. And then the last thing I'll say, it's something that I think about quite frequently when I think about this issue of homelessness. It's, you know, we have a variety of populations of people that we serve, but one of the most significant populations that we've seen need a lot of assistance is the ones impacted by substance abuse and mental health issues. And those we've seen the need there. That, for me, as a municipality, I keep looking to the state for that, because, as you all may remember, we had many mental health facilities, one being AmHi, that used to serve this group of people. And when that facility closed, that need was not sufficiently met. And so we continue to try to make sure that we advocate for expansion of that, whether that be through community providers like, as Allie talked about, Preble Street and other providers that have tried to step up and meet that need, or through other levels of government, and quite honestly, my surrounding municipalities as well, who I also encourage to step into this and really help, because this is a statewide issue that needs a statewide solution involving all of us.
I would just echo what's been said and add to it that it is about silos. That, as Danielle just described, you have homelessness that's actually rather simple. No one does well without housing, and everyone does well with housing. So we just need to solve that. And yet, every single part of the equation is really complicated. From building that housing that Danielle was just describing, it's incredibly complicated and layered, and there are lots of bureaucracies involved, and that part's hard to do. And then delivering services, as Ali said, you're talking about somebody who is without a place to live and who needs to then have success living in an apartment. And what they don't need doesn't fit neatly in the box of mental health treatment or the kind of things that you would bill for mental health services in. And yet, we demand that that's how we're going to pay for the services that people need. When we know when we move somebody in, they actually need help finding a bed. and keeping the friends out who want to come and stay at their place from sabotaging their housing placement. That stuff doesn't fit neatly in the box, and neither does anything else. So the solutions are going to involve us de-siloing the system, having all parts of our system talk to one another, work together, and solve the problem. And unfortunately, our system is set up to sort of point in different directions and say, that should be happening over there, or that should be happening over there. And nothing is set up that really says, let's do this together. And I think the second factor is that we are reactive as a society and not proactive as a society. We know about this in education. It makes sense to start early, and it makes sense to hop in and help people early when they have an issue. And yet our society responds late in the game when it's a crisis, when things have fallen apart. And that doesn't work. It's very expensive. And I'll just take the population that is chronically homeless and just describe for a minute that we have learned that people who are chronically homeless in Portland, and this is real data, going back 3 years, that the same population of chronically homeless people are up to 29 times more likely to be in the hospital, and up to 57 times more likely to be in jail when unhoused than when housed. In fact, in December, just a couple months ago, our group of 20 organizations working to house hundreds of long-term stayers, chronically homeless populations, in December, we've housed 494 people who are chronically homeless working together collaboratively. That's the kind of thing that works. We've had an 89% success rate on getting people housed. But in December, the 450 people who are still alive after getting housed over the last several years, this population dies young and dies early. They die at my age of old age. In December, not a single member of the people who were housed touched the jail or the hospital. Zero. Out of the 140 people who were not yet housed, we had 14 people who were touching the jail and 4 more that were touching the hospital. So literally once we house people, they stop ricocheting through our most expensive emergency systems. And here we have jails that are overwhelmed, and they know that they've got a problem, and there are people there who don't belong there. They're there because they have serious and persistent mental illness and substance use disorder. They're not criminals. They're just getting caught with issues that are landing them there. And then we have hospitals that are overwhelmed in their emergency rooms. I don't know if you've been in an emergency room lately, but you get a bed in a hallway because it's full. Because they're overwhelmed, because the same people are going there night after night, because they're in crisis. And the hospitals know this is not sustainable and we should fix this. And yet the hospitals are not talking to the jails, and are not talking to the homeless shelters, and are not talking to the mental health system or the criminal justice system. Our jails are not a system at all. We have a different jail for every single county in our state, and there are 16 of them. Our criminal justice system is based on Department of Corrections. We don't have any people who are chronically homeless. I think we have 7 in the last 9 years of people who've shown up in our prisons who are chronically homeless. They go to jail for short-term issues. They're not in prison. So here we have systems that we could fix if we were able to do so, and they're not talking to one another, and that's the biggest barrier of all.
Thank you all. Systems comes up quite a bit, right? I want to switch a little bit to, in his opening remarks, President Herbert talked a little bit about encampments, and we expected that that would come up. Directly related to the encampments, at the end of last year, the Portland City Council was considering an amendment to an ordinance to legalize camping on public lands, or to allow camping on public lands for a certain amount of time. Colin, I'm going to start with you. What was your stance on that, or your organization's stance on that, and why?
Well, my stance, my organization, and the Statewide Homeless Council's stance was that everybody deserves to be inside. And I'll just elaborate briefly, if that's okay, that we were late to the game in terms of encampments. This has been happening on the West Coast for a long time. And I don't know if you've been to the West Coast lately, but it's very difficult to walk through San Francisco without stepping over a human being on the streets. And it's been that way in Los Angeles and certain parts for years. But the weather is different out there than it is here. And a lot of the studies that have gone on what to do about encampments have started in the West Coast, where it became a really huge issue. And in the West Coast, 90% of people are unsheltered, staying outside. And that can work because of the climate. And 10% are in shelters. They have a very small shelter system. In Maine, traditionally, we've had 98% of our population indoors in shelters and 2% outside. That's grown lately to 3 to 4%. So our position is to bring people inside to shelter where we're sure that they are safe and help them get into housing, because we're really good at that. Shelters are good at getting people into housing because they're right there and we've got all the resources to help them to make that happen. It's slow, there's not much housing, but that is the right antidote, is to have people indoors and not grow to a level of complacency that somehow it's acceptable to have people out of doors at all. And I am really hopeful that we won't cross that threshold. In the way that we became complacent to allow people to become homeless in the first place in the 1980s, instead of saying this is wrong and we need to keep creating housing and make sure that we include all people in it, I hope we don't cross that barrier of saying it's somehow acceptable to try to live outdoors in Maine, because it is not.
Obviously, I was intimately involved in that decision-making process and watched the council struggle with it. The order would have allowed camping to continue outside, and so I had worked hard prior to that, as I mentioned at the beginning, to try to build capacity, because similar to Cullen, I think staff and I felt very strongly that getting people inside was the right thing to do, especially given the weather conditions here in Maine. And so we worked really hard with the council to try to get expanded capacity at the shelter. I told you we added the 50 beds. Ultimately, that happened in November, like the second week in November. And so additionally, we were working very hard to finish that asylum seeker shelter that I mentioned at 166 Riverside. So that was going to open up a significant number of beds at the Homeless Services Center, which have those targeted services that we've been talking about for our chronically homeless population that was outside. And so it was very much a waiting game. I'm not a very patient person, I will admit that. And so it was really difficult to wait until everything lined up. But that happened. And then, again, give a huge shout out to staff who worked very diligently with many, many community partners to make sure that we were providing outreach services to our encampments, specifically the Harborview encampment, which was located in the city, sort of down by the bridge that goes over to South Portland, and really make sure that we were getting out there, listening to them, trying to help address any sort of barriers that might exist. And then as all of that capacity opened up, we were able to do a push at the beginning of December, about the second week or third week in December, to really get people inside. And it just so happens that happened almost about 3 days before the very, very, very first big major snowfall. So we were very excited that happened in that way, and we were excited to get people inside to make sure that they were safe and getting what they needed. It wasn't easy. I'll be honest, I struggled with it a lot because you just don't know. I mean, it's a very complicated issue, but we were hearing from numerous people about sort of what was happening out there, the concerns, and so getting them inside, I really thought and hoped would be the answer. And what was great was in January 24, the police department put out a briefing on our numbers, and so they keep track of overdose deaths, and then 24, we had zero overdose deaths. And so that's staggering. The last time we could say that was in April 21, 2.5 years before. And so we also saw a 20% reduction in responses to overdoses. We saw an increase, though, in Narcan administration at the Homeless Services Center. So there you could see that, you saw sort of the what, why, and how. What was happening? It was, we got the people inside, we were able to get them the services they need. We have harm reduction services that were provided directly on site at the Homeless Services Center by that dedicated staff I was talking about. And so that really helped. I mean, we saw it specifically in the numbers. I was just astounded by that. So I think we were headed in the right direction doing what we were doing, although I understand it's not the magic bullet and doesn't address everybody's needs. I really think it was the best option that we had and really helped address the critical need that was for these individuals that were outside at that point in time.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that question and to a couple of the points that have been brought up. I mean, I don't think you would find anybody to sit up on this stage and say that they are in favor of encampments. I am, you know, right alongside Cullen and Danielle and pretty much everybody else, I think, when I say that I don't want encampments to have to exist. I want there to be safe shelter and, better yet, safe housing for everybody. We are, you know, when we are faced with the question of whether or not the appropriate or best way to handle the question of encampments is by sweeping those encampments, is by criminalizing people who are staying in encampments, then I personally and Preble Street are come down on the side of that no, sweeping encampments is not the appropriate or the best way in any sense to resolve to resolve encampments or move on from there. I think, you know, what we see with the encampments is that, you know, we know that encampments are not safe places, but the idea that using encampments, sweeping encampments is the solution to that is directly refuted by not just, you know, local anecdotal experience of talking with individuals who are unsheltered and who every time there's a sweep lose their belongings, potentially their IDs that would help them get into housing or help them get employment, that they lose objects, you know, pictures of their family members and children, that they lose the things that they need to potentially remain safe if they can't get into shelter, sleeping bags or tents and whatnot. So it's not only on that, you know, individual anecdotal level that we know that sweeping is not the right way to handle encampments. It's also on a national research-based level. The Journal of the American Medical Association published a study recently showing that for people experiencing drug use, that when you sweep encampments, you are actually increasing the risk of fatal overdoses, you're increasing people's risk of infections, you're decreasing people's connection to service providers, you're decreasing people's connection to, for example, medication-assisted treatment that might help them move forward in their recovery. And so really, I would say even on the local level, I think it's really, really good news that there haven't been any fatal overdoses so far this year. I will say that there are absolutely still overdoses occurring, and right now they're occurring just on sidewalks instead. I know that because in one 24-hour period last month, Preble Street staff responded to 3 overdoses, not of people who are staying in our Elena's Way Wellness Shelter, which is our shelter designed for people who've experienced unsheltered homelessness, but of people who don't have another safe place to be and are sleeping on the sidewalk in the neighborhood. And our staff went out and responded to overdoses because they noticed or were alerted to the fact that there was an overdose occurring. When I walked into Elena's Way this afternoon and was chatting with one of the staff there, asking how the day had gone, oh, well, the day is going pretty well, you know, we had somebody who had a medical emergency, you know, as Cullen referenced, people who've experienced unsheltered homelessness and chronic homelessness are in really bad medical shape, dying 30 years before the rest of the population. We responded to another overdose outside from somebody in the community just this afternoon. So sweeping doesn't mean that people magically go into shelter. I think there was some a really, I think the city and Preble Street and other service providers, Opportunity Alliance Path Team and Milestone and other service providers did some really beautiful targeted outreach to take advantage of the opportunity to lower barriers to the city's homeless services center and through relationship bring people into shelter, and that intentional outreach and that lowering of those barriers resulted in 65 people moving into the shelter in 35 days. I would not say that that was due to the sweeps, and I would say that when you have sweeps and people scatter, you still have that issue, but now you've disconnected people. So I wanted to respond to the sweeps in that way. I also just wanted to respond to the idea that I think it's absolutely the case that everyone deserves to be inside, and that it's not acceptable that we need to have the belief and hold to the belief and act with the belief that it is not acceptable for people to be outside, but that is our responsibility, that we hold it to be not acceptable that the only option for somebody is for them to be outside because they don't have an available resource to them, or a resource that for whatever reason doesn't feel okay to them. What we are not going to do is say that is not acceptable for that person, and we are going to then criminalize that person by threatening them with, you know, incarceration if they don't go to shelter or whatever that is, because that is a failure, and that is just us relying on our power over rather than our ability to deeply listen and understand what is going on for the person. That is also not even a good idea from a resource perspective, because none of those things are resource neutral. Sweeping is not resource neutral. You pull in bulldozers and get people to do sweeps. That's not resource neutral. That costs money. Putting people in incarceration costs money, and then now they have a criminal record, and how much harder is it going to be for them to get housed at that point? So these things are not neutral, and we have a responsibility to ensure that we as the community members who have the ability are setting up the resources that are going to work for people to access them. Not that we are putting putting the impetus or putting the really negative results of our failure of policies to then sustain those to sustain the consequences of those actions.
Thanks, Ellie. I think what you were saying highlights a really good tension. And Danielle, you had mentioned this too, saying we can't be everything to everybody, right? We can't do everything. So then, how do we, as a community, as a government, as services, cities, towns, how do we address individual, you know, especially thinking about encampments, individual and business safety needs, while also ensuring the rights and the dignity of people who are experiencing homelessness? That's a huge meta question, right? What are your thoughts on how we can kind of find a balance there?
Before I jump to that question, the balance is really, really hard. And I just want to make a point of the process that city staff undertook before we resolved encampments. I like to use the word resolved rather than sweep. But no criminalization happened. We had zero arrests. That wasn't even at any of the resolutions that we've ever done. We have staff on site. We provide significant notice. In some cases, many weeks, significant outreach, as Allie described. There's a lot that happens. And then we're very, very careful about belongings. We work with people. We store belongings. We itemize them. We have significant storage at the Homeless Services Center. So the process is very, very, I think, well-managed, well-run. I had leadership team staff. You know, the city has 16 different departments. I had at least 5 department heads at most of these resolutions that were managing it on the site all day long. We provided transportation out to the Homeless Services Center. At the center, we adjusted the way we do intakes, actually doing it on site. As Allie mentioned, reducing any sort of barriers, whether it be curfew-related or other things, staff really worked hard to try to address all of those things. So I have a hard time with the word criminalization, because that, in my experience here in Portland, Maine, at least, was not the case at all. And so I think that, to get back to your question, I was trying to remember now what your question was, because that really got me frustrated a little bit. I understand the viewpoint of Preble Street, but I have a very significantly different take take on that and the way that it was managed. And I will, the last thing I'll say on that piece is that we tried between the end of November and about the middle of December to not set a date that we would be cleaning up the site. I tried that. And I didn't see results. In fact, what happened was there was some additional intakes that were taken, but then it plateaued significantly. And so talking with staff, I said, what are we going to do? You know, we're working very hard. We set up an encampment crisis response team last spring, working with 30 to almost 40 organizations throughout the city to really try and address the issue and really looking at ways in which we could get outreach workers out there. We hired 2 outreach workers at the city to really try and target this and address this. We still weren't seeing people coming inside the shelter. And I know that's for a variety of circumstances, but I will say that as soon as I set the resolution date, we saw movement. That happened before the storm that I was talking about in December. So it's a struggle. It is definitely a struggle, but it's extremely complicated. And we're trying to be, at least at the city of Portland, as respectful of all the interests involved and really taking all of that into consideration and never criminalizing the behavior at all, but really trying to make sure that we help address and provide as much help as possible. So I'll get back to your question.
Thank you. And I also just want to acknowledge that this needs to be a pretty quick last question, so we have enough time for the folks who are attending to ask their questions. So I'm going to, that huge meta question that could solve everything, quickly, what are your thoughts on that, Cullen?
What will solve things, I think, is if we as a community agree on certain principles and then we strive for them. We decide this is what we're going to do. And I honestly believe that it's a mindset that we think that everybody deserves to be inside. And seeing that through can happen. I think the city did an amazing job of this. They did 3 quick things. One was to create capacity, so there's room for people to come inside. 2 was to pull people together to help bring people inside in a coordinated fashion. And 3 was to set a priority for that space for people who are outside. And those 3 things resulted in the space of about 2 months, an 86.5% reduction in unsheltered homelessness in Portland. It's gone down even further. It's 90% from its peak in October. So this works when you bring people together, when you create capacity, and when you coordinate efforts. I think we can do that together on every level in homelessness. We can decide that we want enough housing, and we can insist that our policies call for it. We can decide that we think everybody deserves to be indoors and at least sheltered if we can't get housing right away, and we can make that happen for every person to a person. So it really is on us, as Ali said, to make a mindset. And I think there's a way for us to not ignore all of the complexities that go on here, the complex issues of an unwell mental health system and an unwell substance use disorder system. We need to correct those things, all of these things. We can demand it as a citizenry. We can make this happen. It's on us. And it's just decisions as to what to do.
I'm going to give the last word to you on this, Ali.
Okay, I would say that the solution here is to prioritize the decisions that are going to help keep people alive, first of all, to recognize that not all of the interests of different parties are not all weighted equally, because the costs to one party are different than the costs to another party, and the costs to the most vulnerable folks in the community has to do with life. And so we need to know what our priorities are, and we need to act along those, and we need to ensure that the people who are acting on our behalf do the same. The city of Portland made a decision before you were in your role, Danielle, to walk away from a 30-year commitment they had made to ensuring that there was adequate emergency shelter for everybody who needed it. And we will live with the consequences of that. The people who, again, before you were in your role, Danielle, made the choice to put an emergency shelter 4 miles out of the center of town and then not understand why people wouldn't access it, made a choice, and we're living with the consequences of that. And as we weigh out how we are going to move forward with the consequences of those choices, We need to prioritize life, and we need to have relentless curiosity about what is not working for people so that we can make the systems better. Relentless curiosity over judgment. We have to make that choice every time. Curiosity over judgment. And then on a very practical level, we have to build systems that are going to provide the types and amounts of services that people need. So we need to have spectrums of services that match the needs of the individual or the family before us so that we can be effective. And when we can do that, and when we can bring people back into community effectively, then it's not just that we are prioritizing the needs of the sick and vulnerable individual, we are actually strengthening our whole community, and everybody wins in the end. Yeah.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a forum on Maine's homelessness crisis from the University of New England's President's Forum. For more information on the University of New England's President's Forum, please visit une.edu. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.